This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Listening to a very special edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys with guest Russell Sellers reviewing Marvel's Black Panther.
Once again, everyone out there in Place to Be Nation Popland, to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. I feel like we had some connection issues there, but that's all right. Nonetheless, we are here. And by connection, I mean interpersonal connection, because we are here inside the L-shaped studios in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in beautiful Vancouver.
And serene. Don't forget serene. That's important.
That's true. Beautiful and serene.
Mm-hmm.
Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, for another rousing edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a special off-the-page edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. This is where we review a piece of comic book media that is not a comic book. And in this case, we are continuing Black Panther Month as we address the $200+ million elephant in the room, or panther in the room, I suppose. And we will be giving our exclusive reviews of the Black Panther film, which is currently shattering box office records across the board for Marvel Comics. It is a massive hit. We all predicted it would be a massive hit here at PTBN Pop, and it's probably even exceeded our expectations. And so to join us for such a momentous review of such a momentous film, we decided to reach out to the Place to Be Nation Pop Nation and bring in our good buddy,
the Place to Be Nation Pop Universe.
Well, I didn't want to go that far. I didn't want to, you know, toot our own horns, so to speak.
But
toot. Yeah. And we're bringing in our good buddy, the host of Sellers Points Podcast, right here on Place to Be Nation Pop, Russell Sellers. Russell, welcome to the big show.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be on the quote unquote big show, as he I'm actually, on the quote unquote the little show.
The big show was supposed to be our guest this week, but he had a hip surgery, so he couldn't make it. So you're filling in for WWE superstar The Big Show.
I am a fill in for The Big Show. That I don't know how to feel about that right now.
Hey, you are. We went to the tallest man that we know at Place to Be Nation Pop to fill those giant shoes, and
Todd,
I think
Weber?
We chose well. Todd's a manager. Todd's.
Well, to be fair, we've never actually met Tim. He might be the tallest person we know at Place to Be Nation Pop.
As far as I'm concerned, Tim is a sentient entity that exists inside the internet. So until I actually meet him, I cannot comment on his height or anything else. But one day it'll happen.
And
Mega Powers will.
And then you'll comment on his height and other things, apparently.
Hey, you know what? One thing might lead to another. I love me some Tim Capel.
Precedent has been set. I did share three magical nights in a hotel room bed with Todd Weber upon our first meeting. So,
the manager, Todd Weber.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So all of us, let's let the people in on a little inside secret here about the Place to Be Nation. the three of us, mm-hmm. myself, Nick Duke, my co-host, who I don't think I introduced earlier, but there he is, Nick Duke. I'm Greg Phillips.
What's up?
And Russell, along with other members of the Place to Be Nation, including Jennifer, who is one half of Geek and Sassy, and frequent guest of Place to Be Nation Pop, Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner, among others, went to the movie Cineplex to watch Black Panther this past weekend, and it was a fun time all around, gents.
It indeed was. Pretty great theater that we saw it in, too. I've not had many chances to experience reclining, very comfortably padded seats, but after having seen Black Panther a second time in the local IMAX theater, I can say that the accommodations in glorious Dothan, Alabama were certainly much better.
That's good to hear, actually. And it comes with the added bonus of, in addition to being comfortable and padded, the seats also make fart noises when you try to recline them. So that adds to the entertainment value.
That they do. And they allowed us the opportunity to make really great and aptly timed Austin Powers references as we were trying to get up.
Absolutely. And not to tell tales out of school, but if you actually fart, it's a good way to cover up the sound. Oh, so Nick, your thoughts on the experience?
Oh, it was good. It was a good experience. You know, it's always interesting for me to see a movie in Dothan because it harkens back to my childhood, especially the theater we saw it in most recently, or saw Black Panther in, was the theater I grew up seeing films in when I was like 4 years old. It's that same building that's been there for God knows how long. So always interesting, a little wave of nostalgia walking through the doors of what used to be the old Northside Cinema 2 and is now AMC Dothan 6, I believe, is the technical name of it. But good times all around.
Yes, the same theater that you once saw Batman Forever in.
Actually, that's not true. Batman Forever and Batman and Robin both screened at Circle West when Circle West was a thing back in the day.
Oh yeah, Circle West. Yeah,
Circle West didn't have many notable releases, but they had some over the years. Both the Schumacher Batman films were at Circle West for some reason. All three Lord of the Rings films were at Circle West, and the only other one that I can vividly remember seeing at Circle West was Terminator 3: Rise of the Machines. And I'm sure there were others, but those were the ones that stick out in my mind for some reason.
What was the general state of Circle West? Because it was closed by the time I moved to Dothan. I always imagined it as being like a Pee Wee Herman theater, if you catch my meaning there. He masturbated. The
So Circle West, when I was first coming up, the idea behind it was that it was going to kind of be the adult theater. They mostly showed R-rated or very hard PG-13 films, and more of the family-friendly theater was over.
PG-13 was hard, but something was.
Was over at the north side. Circle West was also older, as you could probably tell, Greg, if you ever actually had the privilege of going in there. And it got to a point where the place became so disgusting that they actually covered the walls with... They covered the walls with curtains, and like when I was a kid, I'd be like, "Why is there a curtain here in front of this wall?" And you'd pull back the curtain, and there you would look at the wall, and there would just be like chewed bubble gum stuck from like you know the ceiling to well, not ceiling to floor because nobody could reach the ceiling, but you get the idea. And it was also the classic like 1980s movie theater floor in that every time you took a step, it felt like your shoes were sticking to the floor a little bit. So it was not good to sum up some of everything up. Although it was the only place in Dothan that had an arcade cabinet for Revolution X, the Aerosmith arcade game.
That's where you shoot CDs at the bad guys, right?
CDs and music notes, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going beyond food capital of the world, Dothan. Holy God! Are you guys seeing these weird numbers that just popped up on our computer screens? Is that just me? Never mind. Good Lord.
Greg Phillips has entered the Matrix. He took the whichever colored pill it was that put him back in the Matrix.
Anyway, we're getting too much into Dothan, and we need to get into the point of this, which is Black Panther, a movie that we were all anticipating, especially, I think, once all the critical buzz started rolling in, we started reading really, really good raves from the critics on this film, from fans as well on this one, and then the box office numbers were just overwhelming, and we'll get to those perhaps a little bit later. But to start things off, let's tell people about our general knowledge or our general understanding of this character or attachment to this character going in. You know, I'll let you start, Russell, because Nick and I have kind of talked about Black Panther the last few weeks here on the show and our relative lack of knowledge of Black Panther before this month of content that we've kind of consumed. And, Russell, I was wondering what it was like for you. For us, it was our primary exposure to T'Challa had been through group context, such as Avengers books or the occasional video game here or there or cartoon. What about for you?
Not all that dissimilar from you guys, actually. I didn't have a ton of knowledge of the character going into the film. I had read the entire Jonathan Hickman Avengers and New Avengers run, which T'Challa played a very big part in. But outside of, you know, a basic knowledge of who the character was, like his background, and maybe a few things about Wakanda and its relation to like a being a, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but they think of it as like a city of the dead or a city of death, where they can commune. What they mean is they can commune with their dead ancestors, and that's something that we actually do see in the film for a few different scenes. But that's played up a little bit in the Hickman run, as well as a an apparent you know, bit of aggression and animosity between T'Challa and Namor, the Submariner. So that's really the extent of my exposure to Black Panther, outside of some random appearances in different cartoons over the years, and then of course his initial appearance in the MCU in Captain America: Civil War.
That was what I was going to get to, Russell. How vital was his appearance in Civil War to getting you hyped for this movie? Because I think for me, that was what really was the turning point for me, where I went from saying, hey, a Black Panther movie, to saying, holy crap, a Black Panther movie. This is going to be great.
I'd say it's absolutely necessary to watch Civil War before you go to see Black Panther. And in fact, did that with a special someone who had never seen Civil War and wanted to go see Black Panther. So I convinced her that we should watch one before the other. And she wound up getting really into Civil War and then into the Black Panther film. But it's really Chadwick Boseman's performance in Civil War that I think really makes it. I observed that as I was watching it again, that he steals every scene he's in. He is just a presence on screen. You can't help but watch him and want to see more of him. And once he suits up as Black Panther that first time, it's all I really wanted to see on screen from that point. I mean, the rest of the movie is really great, but T'Challa kind of becomes the star of the show for me.
Yeah, totally agreed. I thought that coming out of that movie, he was the of all the great performances in that, he was kind of the one that jumped off the screen and really just like rattled me as like, holy crap, this dude just made me care about a character I've never really had an attachment to before. Nick, what about you? Was Civil War important to getting you really hyped for this, or were you already really hyped for this before that?
You know, I couldn't say I was overly hyped. I had a sneaking suspicion even back then that it was going to wind up being a lot bigger hit than people anticipated, especially back then, because the expectations for it were virtually non-existent at the time. And then Civil War came along, and honestly, in a film that so much hype and buzz was built around the debut of Spider-Man in the MCU, Black Panther kind of stole pretty much every moment he was in that movie. I'm thinking specifically of the chase sequence in Civil War that is among the best things the Marvel Cinematic Universe has done to this point. His role in the big airport fight, which of course is, you know, a favorite of both yours and mine, Greg. But also in a movie that really is packed with characters, talking about Civil War, he really does get some emotional moments, some moments to really make you feel for that character and where he's headed. And by the time the closing credits are rolling on Civil War, you're pretty amped for that Black Panther film. And honestly, this one, you know, of the movies that have occurred since then or come out since then, this one feels like the most natural follow-up to Civil War, you know, dealing with a little bit of, you know, actually dealing with some of the fallout from that film, which is something we didn't really see a ton thought of in films like, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 or Doctor Strange or Thor Ragnarok. So that was a big thing. And Russell mentioned, you know, Chadwick Boseman being a scene stealer. I want to call out another scene stealer, that being John Connie, the guy who plays T'Chaka. I want to call out his left eye for stealing pretty much every scene that he is in as well.
Now, Russell, you've seen Civil War just recently. I haven't watched it in a while. How to approach this delicately? Was the left eye noticeable in Civil War? Because I don't remember it.
So delicately that he left. I think I know where he's going with this. Was T'Chaka's left eye drooping in Civil War the way it was in Black Panther? The answer is no.
Okay.
So, I'm taking over the co-hosting duties on this show. Greg has exited.
No, Greg's here. I can hear him.
Oh, I know. I was just trying to take over his spot. Just say yes and we'll move on.
Okay.
Yes. The droopage was not present in Civil War, but it is there in the movie that we're about to talk about, and that is Black Panther. So we all established our excitement levels, our knowledge levels going into this film, and I think right out of the gate, the first thing to talk about here is just our mutual agreement. I think we've all talked about it after the fact that this was a movie that matched the hype. We talk so often about the hype levels hurting movies, and this was one that I had heard a lot about going in and came out very impressed. And we can get into the details here in just a little bit of the things that impressed us or maybe didn't impress us. But would you guys agree with that general assessment that this one pretty well impressed all of us?
Yeah, it definitely impressed me. You know, as of right now, it is the – if you're just looking at Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic and those sort of metrics, it is the highest-rated Marvel Cinematic Universe film released to date. And I don't know if I would quite go that high. If we're talking about meeting that level of hype, I don't know that I could necessarily agree. But in terms of meeting that overall, like – you know, exceptionally high standard that we've come to expect from Marvel and that we especially were expecting from this film, it definitely met my expectations in that regard.
I would say the same. It exceeded some of my expectations, but for the most part, having seen some of the reviews and how well it was being received by the vast majority of critics, my expectations kind of rose a little bit.
Right.
Going in. I was like, okay, let's see if this is really all that good as far as the hype was concerned. And I would say yes. And now having seen it twice, I can say that it actually holds up incredibly well on second viewing. Like maybe some little nitpicky things here and there, but as I describe them that way, they're virtually not worth talking about.
Right. I feel the same way.
Simply because of that. So I would say that Black Panther is that rare movie, much like Captain America the Winter Soldier, where it actually did live up to all of the hype that was surrounding it going in.
And I think from my perspective, one of the reasons that it's been able to do that, Russell, and one of the reasons that I suspect it will hold up very well on multiple watches, is that it's one of those rare Marvel movies that succeeds not on spectacle and not on how big it is, for lack of a better term, but it succeeds and thrives based on the characters and the story, the plot, the things that you can kind of sink your teeth into, apart from the action, apart from the spectacle, the CGI, etc. But really, it succeeds on the strength of its characters. And I think that as far as an ensemble cast of characters goes, this could be the best of the Marvel standalone movies in terms of just creating a cast of characters that I care about, a cast of characters that feel fully fleshed out and three-dimensional, and also capturing a general story that is compelling beyond what we've grown to expect as the, quote, Marvel formula, which may or may not be a fair assertion on movies, but it feels to me like this one is certainly beyond the sort of you know, generic superhero story of something like Doctor Strange or something like that. Mm-hmm. This feels like a story that's going to hold up over time because it's something that will last through time. It's something that never is going to get old or feel dated. Yes, it is speaking – it's saying a lot of things about our culture today, but there are universal truths that are always going to be present and that are always going to be important.
I would agree with that assessment. This movie did I'm very glad that you brought up the ensemble cast feeling this movie has, because usually we have to wait for like big team-up movies like The Avengers or maybe even something like a Civil War to get those big ensemble casts or to make it feel like, you know, all of these characters are really registering and connecting. But that was not a problem for Black Panther, and it was introducing characters that we've never seen before, and it did it incredibly well off of some very talented actors. Specifically, the ladies in this movie kind of steal it away from the main star. Lupita, I'm going to get her last
Nyong'o,
name wrong.
Right?
Nyong'o, yeah, plays Nakia, and I thought that she was absolutely great. She's kind of understated in a lot of ways because she's playing the love interest in the film. But watching it a second time, I was noticing her far more than I did the first time. So that's something that really kind of grabbed my attention. But I think the biggest scene stealer is Danai Gurria. She plays another character whose name I'm going to butcher.
Okoye.
Okoye. She also plays, as people will know, Michonne on The Walking Dead. And you want to talk about a chick who's already demonstrated to us that she's a badass on The Walking Dead. And then she comes into Black Panther and takes it up like two or three notches.
So, yeah, because she's rid herself of the albatross that is Rick and his plans.
Precisely.
I would argue she's rid herself of the albatross that is Carl and the dying death that he's about to die, and it's going to be beautiful here in a few days. But that's just me.
And I have to call out Letitia Wright, who plays Shuri.
Shuri, yeah.
T'Challa's sister. She is absolutely delightful throughout the entire film. She knows how to steal a scene right out from under a Chadwick Boseman who is on top of his game in this movie.
You know, and that's that. I mean, you're absolutely right. The women in this movie are outstanding. I mean, and that's something I had kind of heard a little bit about coming into the movie from various reviews and whatnot, was how great the females were. And what I didn't expect, however, was a guy by the name of Winston Duke who plays the character of M'Baku the Man-Ape from the comics. And honestly, it's a character that if you look a little bit into his comic history, is problematic in many ways. I mean, there are arguments to be made that the original version of that character, as he's originally established, is a little bit of a racist caricature. And they kind of redeem him entirely and make him one of the most entertaining aspects of the movie. He's in the movie far more than you would think for such a character. And by the end of it, he wound up being one of my favorite characters, one of my favorite performances in the entire film. I thought he was just unexpectedly awesome in pretty much everything he did.
I would fully agree with that. I found myself really, especially the second half or the latter portion of the movie where he comes back and plays a big role. He was especially great there. Like, and he gave a very unexpectedly nuanced performance, mm-hmm. Which is not something that would have been suggested from his initial appearance in the film.
Mm-hmm. Right. I thought, I got to be honest, when he first showed up, I didn't put two and two together, and I thought he would just be kind of a disposable character that you wouldn't revisit again. But as it turns out, the kindness of T'Challa makes an impact. And I think that's another key to keeping this movie about T'Challa, even while the side characters and the villain are almost stealing the movie at times. But at the end of the day, it's kept a T'Challa story because it's his actions and it's his strength of character that ultimately saves the day in the end. And I think that's to the movie's credit, that it doesn't lose its lead or its primary character in the midst of building up what I think is one of the most robust supporting casts we've seen, not just in a Marvel movie, but in a superhero movie at all. I think that I made this comment to you guys after the movie that, to me, from a top-to-bottom perspective, taking even the weakest link in the cast, I think this is the best cast of the Marvel movies, which have almost universally been extremely well cast. But this is – I can't think of anyone that I would replace in this film. Everyone is outstanding, whether it's Angela Bassett as Ramonda or even – we haven't mentioned Andy Serkis as mm-hmm. Ulysses Klaue or Klaue from the comics. He's amazing here, incredibly entertaining. Forrest Whitaker as Zuri, and of course we're gonna. I'm sure we're gonna dedicate some exceptional time to Michael B. Jordan mm-hmm. As Killmonger. But
I wanted to mark on something you said there. Isn't it amazing that we can look at a film and say that the weakest links in this movie are Angela Bassett and Forrest Whitaker, and
right.
that they are still absolutely tremendous in their roles.
Absolutely. It's so rare that even the weakest, quote-unquote weakest link in a movie in a performance perspective is still outstanding. And that's the case with this one.
Yeah, and you know, I would mostly agree with what you said, Greg, about not really wanting to replace anyone in the film. If there was going to be one replacement I would make, however, is I would take one of the the Wakandan Council members and have them be replaced by Jim Ross, just to hear him pronounce the names in the film, such as Kazuchika Okoye, for example, would be a good one.
Now we got this feller over here, and his name is T'Challa. He's the son of T'Chaka. Now. When T'Chaka was here, I'm going to tell you something right now, Koye. You and Nakia would not have been throwing your respective weight around as members of the Dora Milaje. However, the Hatoot Zarazi may have executed an execution plan on behalf of Wakabi himself, for God's sake.
M'Baku.
Ramonda. Anyway.
Now, I did want to call out one small performance because we're probably not going to talk about the guy a ton going forward because he only plays a very small role, although it's important, is Sterling K. Brown, who plays N'Jobu. In the short amount of time that he's on screen, especially in my second viewing, he really hits home for me. Like his moments with his son especially are incredibly moving for me, and that's just something that I wanted to call out before
that's
we moved on.
That's a great point. I didn't even think about mentioning him, but I'm glad you did because totally agreed on that. His brief appearances in the movie, and I'm not going to spoil what his role ends up being in the movie, but they are much more vital than you realize, and his performance is much more vital and important to the movie than you realize because if he had really stunk it up in his scenes, I don't know that Killmonger would have been as effective a character if the performance had been botched from his dad. So that's kind of something that really stood out as well. I'm glad you mentioned that, Russell.
Yeah, he's from what I understand a tremendous presence on a little show called This Is Us. So Sterling K. Brown is just one of those guys who's really come into prominence in the last couple of years, and he showed me why in this movie in a very short amount of time.
In addition to This Is Us, which is running right now, he is arguably, in a show that is packed with great performances, he might give the best performance of anyone in the first season of American Crime Story, playing Chris Darden in that season of the O.J. Simpson case. So, you know, if you haven't seen that one, go out of your way to look up that, and I think you'll be impressed with what you find from Mr. Brown.
And former wrestling promoter Jim Barnett loves his first name.
Sterling, my boy.
My boy. So the ensemble cast here.
Now, wouldn't that be a turn of events if Sterling K. Brown played Sterling Golden in the Sterling Golden story?
Really taking some creative license here with the story of Terry Bollea. Anyway, yeah, so great ensemble cast here. I wanted to piggyback a little bit also off of what Russell was saying about the women in the cast. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Nakia was great. I thought Okoye was amazing. To see Michonne get to let loose like that and kind of be a commanding presence in a way that has kind of been pulled back a little bit on The Walking Dead was amazing. And she did a spectacular job. And adding humanity to that character, she's playing this really rigid, stoic warrior persona, but she adds little bits of humility and humanity in there that, to me, round out the character and make it particularly compelling. But in particular, I wanted to point out Letitia Wright as Shuri, because I thought that she stole the scenes that she was in this movie, whether it was her humorous interactions with her brother, complete with the great job of tricking him into punching the suit. I don't want to spoil any more, but it leads to one of my favorite lines in the movie from T'Challa. And and Shuri is just – she's just a little like ball of dynamite that just ignites the screen every time she's on it. And before anyone writes into the show, I'm aware that dynamite doesn't come in ball form, but just imagine that it did and roll with it. She's terrific every time she's on there and adds this joy and this humor and this energy to a movie that can get pretty deep and pretty serious at times with some of the themes that it's approaching, and particularly with T'Challa's journey as a character that you see in this. And we've gone this far and we haven't mentioned a few of the really key players here. And I think before we get on to the two main stars, arguably, outside of the terrific women that we mentioned, let's talk about Everett Ross. And Nick, particularly, I want to get your take, because we've been kind of getting more familiar with Mr. Ross through our long book hunt on the Christopher Priest run on the comic, where this character was introduced. And in this case, it's Martin Freeman playing Mr. Ross. And what did you make of this take on our favorite government agent?
You know, I enjoyed it. I you know, it's kind of like, I won't say it's a direct adaptation of the Everett Ross that we were introduced to in the first volume of the Chris Priest run. I think the Chris Priest version of the character is a little bit more comedic. Not that Everett Ross didn't have his funny moments. He definitely did. But he wasn't the butt of jokes the way he was often in the Chris Priest run. But much like the Priest run, there's an argument to be made that for a large portion of this film's audience, and an audience that you know, you, Greg, and Russell, and myself, we all fall into, for the non-black audience, he's kind of the point of view character. He's kind of the character who is being exposed to this whole world that he didn't know anything about and is kind of being, you know, continually amazed and having things revealed to him that he didn't know how to expect. And that's kind of, I think, he's kind of supposed to be the stand-in for a portion of this audience. So I thought he did a great job. I was worried that they were going to focus on him a little too much, but I thought he was in the movie just the right amount and did a really good job with the material he was given. And I look forward to seeing how they're going to incorporate that character into other MCU films going forward. I did find it interesting that he explicitly mentioned that he was a former Air Force pilot, and so could there potentially be a role for him in something like Captain Marvel, which, as we all know, is going to be a flashback movie to the early 90s?
I think that's probably a strong possibility. Maybe some of that amazing de-aging CGI can be played on Martin Freeman.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Make him look a little bit more like he did in The Hobbit. But that's another thing that's really impressive
the
about
white
me.
Jerry girl of The Hobbit.
That's another thing that impresses me about him is that he's playing an American character, but he has a pretty thick British accent whenever you listen to him just speaking. Mm-hmm. And he covers it up incredibly well. He never slips out of it. But Everett Ross as a character is actually one that I have a pretty strong blind spot for, because I've never really experienced him in the comics. Though through you guys reading the Priest run and your show on that, I did learn a bit about him, so I had a good laugh whenever there was a point in the movie where he is sans pants.
Yes, he is. He is a character that I was happy to see that they added some humor to in this one. They kept him competent, certainly, but I was glad that they seemed to take a more comedic tone with him in this one than when he was first introduced in Civil War. So, big fan of what he did here. But let's get on to, I think, the performance that has been the most talked about out of this movie, and the character that has been the most talked about out of this movie, and that is N'Jotica, a.k.a. Eric Stevens, a.k.a. Killmonger, or Eric Killmonger if you're a comic book fan. And this is the performance, of course, Michael B. Jordan, who has been in several hit films, Fruitvale Station, Creed, where he also worked with the director, Ryan Coogler, who we'll talk about a little bit later as well. Also had the unfortunate distinction of playing Johnny Storm in the failed Fantastic Four relaunch a couple years ago. We'll talk about redeeming yourself. He can join Chris Evans in the Fantastic Four Redemption Club, because the more I've thought about this movie, the more I've come to the realization that for a one-and-done villain, I think this is my favorite in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I say one-and-done, I'm not making any indications as to whether he'll return in the future. I'm saying that for a villain in a standalone Marvel movie, even over the Vulture, I would say that. The Vulture was awesome, but to me, even beyond that, was what we saw with Killmonger in this movie. I think it is a landmark performance in the MCU. I think it is a landmark job of writing in the MCU. This is one of the most three-dimensional characters, hero or villain, that we've encountered. And in my estimation, anyway, this is the first standalone villain in the MCU that I think can match up to some of the great villains of the other superhero movie studios, Magneto from Fox and the Joker from Warner Brothers. It's a transformative performance to the degree that I didn't see the Michael B. Jordan of Creed, Michael B. Jordan of any of his other appearances that I've seen him in. I saw Killmonger. And I saw a movie that takes a character named Eric Killmonger and manages to not only de-cheesify him, but to make him awesome in a way that people are leaving the theater saying, "Holy crap, how cool was Killmonger?" Which you never would have heard from somebody reading the comics. So I just can't say enough about this performance, this characterization. It's one that's going to stand the test of time. It's one that I think is going to be used as a point of study for future Marvel movies and for future superhero movies in general. I'm floored by how good this was.
Yeah, I completely agree with that assessment. The only thing that character needed was a flashback to him meeting Obadiah Stane at one point and having Jeff Bridges come back to give him his Killmonger nickname. But other than
and the unfrozen clone corpse of Hitler, known as the Hatemonger from the comics.
Yes.
Had all three mongers together.
But no, in all seriousness, it seems like over the last several Marvel films, Marvel is starting to learn a lesson that I think another of our favorite pastimes could do well to remember at times, and that is that, you know, prestige and money are all great for the basis of characters or the basis of rivalries, but personal issues, when they are presented first and foremost, and you have a reason to understand these villainous characters, that, you know, that goes a long way. I mean, look at the last several Marvel villains, going back to Helmut Zemo in Civil War. That guy has a very deeply personal motivation that makes him, in the end, much more compelling than any comic book counterpart of his that I've read. Same could be said for the version of Adrian Toomes that is used in Spider-Man Homecoming, mm-hmm. and of course here Eric Killmonger. And then go all the way back, of course, I think the most notable Marvel villain at this point has been Loki, who certainly has an understandable personal motivation. And when they give these guys real stakes and real reason for us as an audience to sink our teeth into what their plans are and why their plans are the way they are, it's a lot easier to get yourself invested into the story of the movie and kind of get lost in the performance than it is with something like, say, generic businessman Darren Cross or whatever his name was in Ant-Man. That I've literally already forgotten his name. or numerous other Marvel villains from especially early on in the MCU pantheon. So more villains like this with real believable motivations, please, because that has been, it seems like Marvel has finally gotten the lesson there and is starting to crank out memorable villains left and right over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I would even add Hela and Ego the Living Planet to the pantheon of excellent Marvel villains. But going off of Killmonger, which, yeah, no, what a name. you can definitely tell 60s era in full effect here. But, it's a testament to the writing and to the commitment to this character that they didn't immediately lean onto his other moniker, his other villain moniker, which is Golden Jaguar. And that he still winds up becoming Golden Jaguar in the film, though they don't call him that, was actually kind of cool to me. Like, we get to see the Golden Jaguar costume on screen and how it is remarkably similar to the Black Panther suit. But that was neither here nor there. That was just a little like nerd thing that that I found to be cool that they would actually like fully go there with it. And
it's a good it's a good example of having your cake and eating it too. So to
it speak. really was. But again, everything you guys have said about Michael B. Jordan's performance is right on. I don't know how I can really add much to that, except to say that he's continuously proving himself to be one of the premier actors of our time, and that he's not above doing films like this is just a great benefit to all of us comic book nerds who want to see him do more of this type of stuff.
Yeah, I think we have some ideas on that, right, Russell?
we might have had a discussion, a brief idea of him putting on a certain ring, and it kind of made us, feel a little green, but in a very positive way.
Well,
if
for some reason Michael B. Jordan can't do it, just turn to the same film and grab Sterling K. Brown. I mean, that would be another phenomenal choice for what you guys are throwing out there.
As would Daniel Kaluuya.
Yeah,
there you go.
Who is a guy who we haven't called up, but he plays Wakabi in this film.
That's right, he does. And, yep.
And is a tremendous actor. If you guys haven't seen Get Out, I highly recommend you do it. He really kills it in that movie, and he continued to be like he's a supporting character here. He maybe has one of the most understated performances in this entire film, but he doesn't know how to not bring his A game. So I would actually fully buy him in another certain superhero role that I don't think we have to mention its name here.
Yeah. Get it, Big Dan. we always love a good Oh Brother, We're Art Thou reference here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. With all that being said, let's get to some other elements of the film. Actually, before we get anywhere else, let's go to T'Challa himself, Chadwick Boseman, because that was
we've talked about the least.
Yes, I know. We've talked so much about
not just us, kind of the entire villain. Kind of the entire discussion around this movie. If you read reviews, if you listen to the response to it, I mean, T'Challa has almost been an afterthought for a lot of people in his own movie, and that isn't to say that he's not good. He's great. It's just it really is indicative of how fantastically cast and performed this movie is from top to bottom.
True. And remember the conversations after The Dark Knight.
Right.
What were they about? They were about the Joker. They were about Two-Face.
Yep.
They were about even Alfred.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Lau, of course, maybe the most underrated performance of the film, but very little talk about.
But just accidentally.
but very little talk about Christian Bale as Batman, even though he was very good in the movie. Now, in this case, what my statement to that would be: yes, at times it feels like the villain and the side characters are in danger of taking over the entire film because they're so good and they steal so many scenes, but It is through Chadwick Boseman's sheer charisma and his commitment to this character that that doesn't happen in my eyes. Because, yes, we've talked about how great all these performances were, but this movie falls apart without Chadwick Boseman. This movie does not work fundamentally without Chadwick Boseman's performance. If he's even a little bit less than what he is in this movie, it's not successful as a superhero movie. Because at the end of the movie, you shouldn't be saying, damn, T'Challa's lame and Killmonger was awesome. I don't think anyone's saying that. I think people are saying, yeah, Killmonger was awesome and he had some good points. But you see how T'Challa takes those points and allows them to grow his own character. And Boseman's performance in this movie is stellar. And it's one of those performances that I think we're going to look fondly on years in the future, where I think people are going to go back a little bit like Christian Bale to me, who got a little bit slammed because of the Batman voice. But I think when people go back and watch this movie in 5-10 years, I think people are going to realize, kind of like they do with Bale in those movies, where his performance is needed to hold that movie together. Even if he's not doing anything spectacular, even if he's not necessarily putting on the tour de force that a Heath Ledger or a Michael B. Jordan are, Boseman is really the one that is holding this whole thing together through his hero's journey. And to me, of all of this new Avengers era that we're seeing crop up on the big screen, we all have an Avenger that we cater to more than the rest, even though we love all of them. And I think he might be mine of this new crop. Like, Spider-Man's great. I'm sure Captain Marvel's going to be great. Doctor Strange is fine. But I think, to me, I think Black Panther's going to be my guy, if that makes sense.
It's hard to argue with that because he is just so magnetic when he's on screen. And like you, all the things you were saying were absolutely right on, because you can have all these really great performances from these individual characters, but if there's not chemistry between your actors, what good is it? And Chadwick Boseman has incredible on-screen chemistry with every single person that he is on screen with. And that's the testament to how good he is, because it seems like no matter who you pair him up with, he's going to give you a good, it's a great scene that feels like these two characters have known each other forever. There was never a sense of falseness about how he played the character and how he interacted with those around him. And even when he finally meets Eric Stevens or Killmonger's character, it's instantaneous. That chemistry that it takes between a hero and a villain to really make it sing on screen. It's that animosity. It almost feels like a natural animosity between these two, almost like they legit didn't like each other until a little bit later on, because you can't help but, and I think it's through the power of Boseman's performance, he feels bad for the villain. Ergo, we start to feel bad for the villain.
Exactly.
And that is, those two elements together make Michael B. Jordan's performance that much more compelling, because when you find out that backstory, and when T'Challa is finding out that backstory, it's breaking his heart. And when you stop and think about the social commentary metaphor that is for different parts of society, you start to, internalize and start to feel a little bit of your own guilt coming up. Because it's not necessarily that you did this to this person, but you start to see why this person might have a certain level of resentment or even outright hatred for you and how they became what they are. So then you start to wonder, well, what can I do to make the world around me better? And that's the hero's journey that T'Challa actually goes on. I mean, sure, there's cool action, great drama and suspense, but I think at the heart of Black Panther, that feels like what Ryan Coogler was really trying to get across in his directing of this film.
Nick, your thoughts on Boseman?
Oh, yeah, I mean, he's great. I mean, you guys have pretty much nailed it. you can have a great villain, you can have a great cast around him, you can have a great story, but without a pretty good central performance, all that stuff doesn't really matter. You got to have some glue to hold the movie together, and he is the glue and does a phenomenal job of it. I'm very intrigued to see where he takes his character going forward in ensemble films, because the odds are that, you know, in something like Infinity War, his supporting cast, you know, his specific supporting cast probably won't get as much time as he will, and he'll have that opportunity to really shine through, albeit in limited screen time in movies like that and in a Black Panther sequel. So I think as good as he was here, I think bigger and brighter things are ahead for that portrayal going forward in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Agreed. And if even a portion of the original Avengers cast truly is riding off into the sunset after the Infinity War movie or its follow-up, I could totally see T'Challa front and center leading the new Avengers, if you will. So I think that's certainly something that we could see in the future. So let's move on to the director, Ryan Coogler, who he directed Creed. He did Fruitvale Station. He's done several critically and financially acclaimed movies in his career to this point. He also, in addition to directing this movie, he wrote it. He co-wrote it with Joe Robert Cole, who has gained great acclaim for his work writing, as Nick mentioned this earlier, The People vs. O.J. Simpson for FX. So this writing team and this director, he's kind of been one of the hot young names in Hollywood for the last couple years. He's had a great deal of success, and this is basically his third feature film, coming after Fruitvale Station in 2013, Creed in 2015, and for a director that young, that new to making blockbusters, this is certainly the biggest budget he's ever had to work with, $200 million budget for this movie, and to create, in many ways, a modern classic like this just speaks to his overwhelming talent, because this is a guy that we have all, the three of us, have enjoyed his work. I haven't actually seen Fruitvale Station, full disclosure. It's on my list. But, of course, I've seen Creed, and I thought he breathed life into a franchise that seemed like it was out of oxygen, and seems to have that Rocky franchise almost reinvigorated and reimagined for a new generation with Michael B. Jordan in the lead. And this is a script and a movie that I think really just blew me away when I was watching it. I talked a little bit about the writing earlier and how crafting these three-dimensional characters was so impressive for a superhero movie. But the pace, it cuts a good pace. Even the slower scenes are vital and important. Everything means something in the movie. Every character interaction means something in the movie and informs the portrayals around them. What did you guys make of the performance from Coogler here? And what do you see as his future within both this franchise and this genre?
I would think that, especially after the success of Creed, as you mentioned, and then, of course, this is the biggest blockbuster success he's ever had and is going to make him a real hot commodity in Hollywood. I think that he's going to be fielding offers from pretty much every corner of the big-budget Hollywood arena. But Disney has to know what kind of success they have on their hands here, much like how Warner Brothers for some odd reason didn't sign Patty Jenkins to a multi-picture deal with Wonder Woman until after the first movie's great success. The same thing has seemingly happened here with Coogler at Disney, as they did not sign him to a multi-picture deal for Black Panther or for anything else for that matter. But after proving his mettle here, I would think that Disney would be just throwing money at him to keep him in their stable and offering him whatever creative freedom he wants to keep the Black Panther franchise going. And if let's I'm just going to put this out there. If, let's say, the Russo brothers are done with Avengers after they wrap up Avengers 4, if that is going to keep going, if you're going to do like a new Avengers film and try to keep that franchise alive, I think this might be your guy.
Yeah.
I think he's the smart money choice to keep that going. Not unlike how James Gunn was the smart money choice to keep Guardians fresh and fun and going. They've also given him, you know, a lot of latitude, a lot of creative freedom. And I think that in order to keep Ryan Coogler around, they're going to have to give him a strong measure of freedom, because I could also see him saying, well, this was fun. I'm going to go on and write and direct just some original pieces, which I would actually personally love to see happen, because I think this guy has probably got some ideas that we know nothing about yet. But it's, I think it's in the realm of possibility that he might get tired of this whole like franchise picture thing and decide to give us the next great original film, which is mm-hmm. something that I personally would be incredibly excited to see. So either way, but I think the sky's the limit as far as Coogler's concerned. He, after turning out the largest single weekend opening ever for any superhero movie, congratulations, pal. You can write your own ticket in Hollywood right now.
Well, what about, you know, let's look at what he really did with this film. You've got fantastical concepts, an immensely diverse cast, some great action sequences, a little bit of sci-fi sprinkled in there, and I think there's another imprint there at Disney right down the hallway that is currently in the, you know, rumored to be looking for female and minority directors to come in and inject some diversity into their lineup. Why not Ryan Coogler for his own big budget take on the Star Wars universe, whatever he wants it to be? Because Star Wars is one of those things you can pretty much do anything you want. There isn't like a preconceived notion, because you can kind of go off in different areas, much like Rian Johnson is going to get to do with his trilogy, much like the Game of Thrones guys are going to get to do with their series of films. I would personally love to see Ryan Coogler come on and do some Lucasfilm stuff. I know that's probably not in the cards, but you know, anything Disney can do to keep him around at either of their two major in-house nerd studios, I would be all for at this point. Especially if it gave us Michael B. Jordan wielding a lightsaber at any point, which I think is the ultimate nerd fantasy at this point.
Now, as the much ultimate as I would nerd love fantasy to see is that, him wielding a construct from a ring, my friend.
Now, as much as I would like to see a lightsaber in his hands, don't tell Twitter that you can't. You can do whatever you want with Star Wars, because they might disagree with you. That's neither here nor there. I'm all for Coogler getting a Star Wars film, getting any film, honestly.
Right.
At this point, I think it's – I see his name as the director. I feel like I got to see it.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and he could, to both your points, he could go into a big blockbuster franchise, which would be awesome. But it would also be awesome for him to start his own blockbuster franchise. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's like what I'm
something
saying.
Something that you know, isn't rooted in the imaginations of George Lucas or Steven Spielberg or
and there's no reason,
Stan Lee.
And there's no reason you can't do both. I mean, as long as the studio is willing to work with him. I mean, Chris Nolan did it. Now, he came and gave us a, you know, the Batman trilogy for all time, but also in the in-between years went off and worked on original projects.
Yep.
And there's no reason that people shouldn't be able to do that these days. And I know the superhero movie schedule especially is so fast-paced now that they want to crank out these sequels at a seemingly, you know, impossible rate to keep up with, to the point where, you know, guys like James Gunn or, you know, to a lesser extent, Zack Snyder haven't really been able to have careers outside of these franchises. But that doesn't mean that has to be the approach for everyone. And I would hope that Disney, if you have a guy like Coogler who does express an interest in outside projects, you would have the wisdom and foresight to say, okay, even if it means waiting a year or two on, you know, Black Panther stuff or whatever he's going to be involved with for us, it's worth that long-term investment to keep him around.
Now, if you really want to do something like really bold as far as like Coogler maybe taking on a different franchise, one that Black Panther also reminds me a good bit of.
Yeah, I know where you're going with this.
It would be for him to take on and finally give us that Idris Elba James Bond.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, Russ, because that's actually exactly where I was going to go next. This movie, unexpected – I don't know what I really expected going in, but I did not expect to feel at times like I was watching a James Bond movie. And there are sequences particularly – and I don't know what it is about Hong Kong as a –
it's men in suits, Greg. It's men in like high-class environments who are there doing like these weird – you know, these clandestine operations that kind of gives it that feel. But yeah, that entire casino sequence.
It just works in these movies.
Yeah.
Whether it was Batman, whether it was a James Bond with Skyfall, or whether it's this movie, there's something about that scenery that just gives it that feel. And it certainly at times felt like this could have been a James Bond movie in some regards. That casino sequence may have been the best sequence in the film in terms of an action.
I think it easily was. I mean, especially if you count the casino and the ensuing chase, that they kind of flow right into each other. Mm-hmm. I think that is the best sequence of the film from my perspective anyway. Because, you know, I understand the Wakanda stuff was great, don't get me wrong. And there's a, you know, that's kind of the beautiful thing about this movie is depending on who you are and what you want out of it, there are different things that are intended to speak to you. The Wakandan stuff, you know, which delves heavily into African culture, is clearly intended to speak to audiences of a different demographic than us. But the moments where it felt like a Black Bond movie, essentially, were the moments where I was like, this is something I recognize, and this is something I love, and this is, you know, it's kind of firing on all cylinders at this point. Because I'm like you, Greg. I thought that Hong Kong sequence was, to me, the most thrilling bit of the movie. And I would absolutely love to see him take on James Bond, although I can't in good conscience move him up to my number one choice on the list, because my all-time like fantasy movie that's still out there could potentially happen one day. So right behind Chris Nolan, he'd be a good number two on the potential Bond director list in my head.
Sure. That whole South Korean bit was really great.
That's right. It wasn't even Hong Kong technically. It may have been filmed there. But
they did film on location in South Korea, which was, I think that was a big important thing for Ryan Coogler, was to film in real places to make it feel truly authentic, because Wakanda is a fictional place and is one that, you know, how do you create that? And a lot of that was actually created on sound stages in Atlanta. But
at least they were actual sets.
Yes, they were actual real sets, but that's another testament to this guy's filmmaking abilities. He made Wakanda feel like a real place. He made it feel like it had its own culture, its own unique look. That's the important thing, it felt real. I didn't feel like I was watching something that was just created on a green screen. Hell, Wakanda is a complete, like, much like Gotham City in Batman v Superman. It's a completely fictional place. But, oh my God, when you watch Batman v Superman, you can tell that what you're looking at is a green screen city.
I was gonna say Justice League, because you can tell that everything that happens in Justice League is a green screen, but that's neither here nor there.
I said, there again, both of those movies have that same problem. They're trying to create these unique cityscapes and say, oh, we want this to feel like a real place. Well, my eye can tell that it doesn't exist. And even though I knew that opening sequence when they fly into Wakanda for the first time, it's breathtaking, even though I know what I'm looking at doesn't even exist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was great to see a different setting in a superhero movie from what – I mean, so many of these movies, by nature of being Marvel movies, take place in New York.
New York, yeah.
Or take place in a prominent American city. And so it was great to see this sort of built from the ground up imaginary locale in a different environment than what we're used to, from in a way similar to something like – the set pieces in Tim Burton's Batman, you know, where it made Gotham City feel like its own character. Here, Wakanda feels like its own character.
Yes, it has its own culture happening around it. Like, you see people interacting with each other. You see a public transit system going. I mean, that's a small thing, but it's kind of big, honestly, for this city that is really coming alive. You see people just buying food on the street and just like talking and hanging out, like this is life, like this is a, you know, slice of life inside this city. These people are in a kind of an open area. So Wakanda itself gets to just go on existing, at times you'd think maybe even blissfully unaware of what's going on with their political leaders. And yep. that is a tremendous achievement to pull off for a first-time film in a place that has never been seen in the MCU before.
Completely unrelated, but you want to talk about Wakandan culture. There was one bit there near the end of the film in that closing action sequence that made me realize that if they ever get around to doing an MCU version of the Rhino, I want him to be Wakandan and take inspiration from this particular idea that they had in this movie. So we'll see if that ever winds up happening.
I was absolutely digging that part of the movie, surprisingly enough.
You mean you don't want him to be Paul Giamatti in a giant mech suit?
Listen here now. You're not going to get me to say anything about Paul Giamatti, no matter how hard you may try, sir.
Lady in the Water.
I've never actually seen it.
And you're better off for it. Nevertheless.
Not to take this podcast sideways or anything.
Sideways! There's one I haven't watched in a long time and never will again.
Why did you watch it in the first place? You, Greg, watched a movie around people sitting around and drinking. Like,
I would suggest
what about
you
that?
Ask our mutual friend Mr. Woodles about that.
Oh God, what a surprise!
Yep, me and Sam watched that together in college. But anyway, that's my college exploits are not for this podcast.
It's no Running with Scissors, that's for sure.
Running with Scissors. Now, Sideways was much better than Running with Scissors. I'll say that on the record. On the record, sir.
Master of the Forum.
I've already lost track of where I was going with this. Oh, yeah. I would like to apologize, by the way, folks, for saying Hong Kong for that sequence earlier. But the reason I said that had nothing to do with stereotyping Korea and China and everything to do with the fact that the scene reminded me of the Hong Kong sequence from Skyfall and the Hong Kong sequence from The Dark Knight, mm-hmm. which are both tremendous and among my favorite superhero action sequences.
It's also because Greg has no soul. Soul? South Korea? Nothing?
What about my Pyeongchang? I don't know. That's where they're doing the Winter Olympics right now, which everyone is watching instead of listening to this podcast, I'm sure.
Yeah, because pretty much life stops during the Winter Olympics. Nobody really goes anywhere or does anything or watches any television, as we'll discuss in the back half of the show.
Just ask the CW network. Yeah.
I never understood how curling was such a popular thing, but oh my God, I know like four or five people who watch it, and I'm like,
yeah,
but why?
Yeah.
But okay,
sometimes I do amateur curling in my kitchen when I'm sweeping up. my yearly sweep of the kitchen.
Cheese curling doesn't count.
No. If it did, I'd be doing well. Given
at the mention of a yearly sweep
doctor,
of your kitchen, somewhere David Sunday just died a little inside.
He's been there. He knows exactly what to expect.
I can't believe he showers in your shower. That is still one of the most bewildering things about you, about your friendship.
Listen. My shower gets the job done. Andrew Garner informed me that it is the most powerful water pressure that he's felt in a shower in quite some time.
I was disappointed that Garner didn't bring his African artifacts with him to the screening
That's
of the film.
A great
to display
point.
How
we need to get him on before Black Panther. Unfortunately, this is the end of Black Panther.
Yes,
month.
It is.
Perhaps if we have another Black Panther month, we need to bring him on to discuss his African artifacts and what exactly the tale and his great hatred of country artist Clint Black.
Yes. If it had been the Clint Black Panther, Garner would not have been a fan.
He wouldn't have attended. It'd be a good run of bad luck for him. But anyhow, yes.
It'd have been Killmonger time.
So we've talked about all this great stuff. Real quick, let's hit up anything that kind of didn't work for us in the movie, because there were maybe a couple of things I'll just start out, I guess, but so while I really loved that sequence in South Korea at the casino, while I really loved the especially the I can't remember what they were called, the ceremonial fights that the Black Panther has to have to gain or lose his position as the Black Panther and the King of Wakanda.
They just called him a challenge.
Yeah. A challenge. And the ultimate challenge. But I will say that I think much in the same way of Christopher Nolan in Batman Begins, this is a case of a great young director who really had his first opportunity to direct big budget traditional action scenes. What I mean by that is, yes, we saw Creed, but boxing fights, especially on film, are much different from a traditional action film fight. And so I thought that, kind of like Batman Begins, some of the fights here, it was a little tough to tell what was going on. And of course, it did have the uniquely modern issue of the CGI reliance at times, particularly in the last fight between the Black Panther and Killmonger. There are sequences in there that come off really, really fake-looking, really, really
cartoony. Especially when it reaches its second stage and it's kind of taking place beneath the surface of Wakanda, and it moves to a clear green screen, which is, man, green screen has kind of become one of those things that just sticks out like a sore thumb in superhero movies, and I think people would be wise to take the Chris Nolan approach of only doing it when it's absolutely necessary and there's no other way to get around it.
Yeah, and I think that in this case, that stood out a little bit, and there were a few of the action scenes before that, even with the Black Panther in action, even his first action sequence, where it's a little hard to tell what's going on. And I think that's something that Coogler is going to learn from going forward and get better and better at, because I thought Nolan had largely solved that issue. He figured out how to direct these fight scenes better in his later Batman movies. And in Inception, of course, which has some great sequences. I think Coogler is going to get there in no time because he has some good fights in this movie. But those are pretty much the only things I can think of that stood out to me negatively.
Yeah.
What about you guys?
Speaking of the action, one of the things I wanted to mention was, you know, and it's nitpicky for sure, but I thought while it was a cool moment when it was first pulled out in South Korea, you know, that power where he can kind of, you know, redirect, take in kinetic energy in the suit and then kind of redirect it outwards, I thought it was overused a little bit as the film went on. I know it happened, I think, twice in the closing action sequence alone, which I thought was, they went to that well one too many times for my taste.
A little bit like the Wonder Woman crossing the bracelets thing.
Right, yeah, exactly. And then, other than that, the only other very minor complaint I could have is that at times, it felt like the dialogue was a little, you know, a little expository, a little on the nose, but I can't really fault it too much because much like, you know, a far worse movie in Green Lantern, there's a lot of mythology they're trying to fit in here. And I know we should always, you know, show rather than tell, but with a lot of this stuff, sometimes you can't get around, you know, telling in a 2-hour runtime. And, you know, they did the best they could, but there were moments where I kind of went, okay, I just feel like I'm having the history of Wakanda and the whole deal with the Black Panther read to me. But those moments were few and far between, so not even too much of a complaint there.
Yeah, and I can't think of a non-expository superhero movie off the top of my head. So, Russell, what about you?
You guys pretty much called it out. It's the there were a couple of times whenever the CGI was incredibly obvious, and it's the same trap that pretty much every major superhero film has fallen into at some point or another. And like Christopher Nolan, it's really the camera work that kind of becomes a problem during some of the action sequences. They made the – I guess it's a creative decision, but it's one I disagree with. It's when they get too close to the action, and you need to back the camera up and stop shaking it around so damn much. It's right. We need to be able to see what's going on screen, because we all know that Chadwick Boseman can pull off these fight scenes. He did it in Civil War, and he did it incredibly well. And there are even times in this movie whenever he's definitely doing it. So I know that the fight choreography wasn't the issue. I think that just it's a weird creative decision that has only come around in the last decade or so that they want to get close and they want to do shake cams, I guess, to make you feel like you're part of the action, but it tends to have the opposite effect on me. It takes me out of it.
And to your point, Russell, one of the best pieces of action cinematography in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is the closing action sequence of Civil War, where there's an entire part of that fight where the camera is stationary and Iron Man is in the center of the screen and the camera just stays on him as Captain America and Bucky come from the left and right and alternate position. The camera doesn't shake, it doesn't get too close, and you can see like all their movements and how the entire fight is playing out while the camera remains in one position. And I think that is a lesson that I think the MCU in general could learn more more of. I'm not saying every fight needs to be on a stationary camera, but I think moving less and pulling back a little bit more would not be the worst ideas.
Exactly. At least let us see some of this happening so that we can get a feel for how this fight is going to flow, and then you can maybe intersperse
right.
some of that close-up stuff to emphasize like stronger hits or something.
And
like,
I mean, it goes without saying that if you ever feel like it's going to be an issue, I think pulling out is always the best way to go.
You know, generally speaking, for safety's sake, mm-hmm. for safety's sake, yeah, you know, unless you have other measures in place.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah,
and Greg is uncomfortable.
I live for a soundtrack of Greg Ez and David Sunday Size. Those are my favorite sounds in life.
Yeah, you got any yum? Anyway, that's an inside joke that no people will get. Anyway, moving on from that. All of that was good. But Russell, I have many thoughts on this matter that perhaps will be better saved for if we ever do our action movie pod blast series at some point. But
got to be a thing that happens.
Yes, but one thought I will say is I think that. As great as they are, and I love these movies, the Bourne series, they were so good at the shaky cam thing, and they started it really, and they perfected it, that it created this movement, much like the Matrix did with Bullet Time,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
where there's almost been an obsession with it in Hollywood, and I don't know this for a fact, but my working theory that someone could probably disprove if they know more about the facts of this, my working theory is that this is a way for studios to save on fight choreography because the great fight choreographers, you don't really have to pay someone to be a great fight choreographer if you're going to use shaky cam because you have to, especially – well, I say nowadays people do this because the Bourne series had great choreography. But nowadays you'll see movies where the fight choreography is almost non-existent. It's just quick cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally don't have to do anything. So I think that's part of it, and it's an unfortunate legacy of a great movie series in the Bourne series. And at some point, some new action movie will come along and create something brand new that will influence the next generation of action movies. More so, you know, and kind of take over for that. But it just feels like this has lasted a little bit longer than Bullet Time did as a thing. I think people got over Bullet Time quicker than they have shaky cam. So,
yeah, it has been unfortunate. But you know, in the case of Bourne, at least they still choreographed a full fight scene, whereas
yes.
a lot of these other movies seems like they don't, and they just
right.
They do that quick cut thing to hide the fact that they couldn't afford a choreographer, I guess.
Right. The what's the name of the guy that was the choreographer on the prequel movies for Star Wars and also played Toad in X-Men?
Oh, Ray Park.
Ray
Park. He needs to be getting work again. That guy was awesome. Anyway, moving on from all that. Final thoughts on Black Panther. I'm just going to let you guys say whatever thoughts you haven't mentioned to this point in the podcast. So, Nick, let's start with you.
You know, suffice it to say, I absolutely, you know, loved this film. I thought it was outstanding. I can't really say at the moment where it falls, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe pantheon. That's for another time, quite frankly, when we will re-examine this film a few months down the road as we build to the close of the Marvel Cinematic Universe after, you know, to this point anyway, with the release of Avengers 4 next year and our Hard Travelers for Hire series comes to its end. So, it's definitely up there, though. I know it's in the top half somewhere. Where it falls exactly, I would really have to sit down and think about. But it just goes to show you that Marvel continues to be a reliable indicator of quality. They have yet to really disappoint. Pretty much, if you go to the theater and something has that Marvel Studios name attached to it, you're going to walk out with at minimum having had a really good time at the movies. And in this case, you know, having had one of the more unique and special cinematic experiences that we've had in pop culture in quite some time.
Go ahead, Russell.
I would fully agree with that. We've said I've said pretty much every great thing I can about the film, and it deserves all of those accolades and more. Like Nick, it's hard to say exactly where it's going to fall for me, but having seen it twice now, I feel comfortable saying that I think this is going to wind up top five for me after a couple more watches. And, you know, maybe not top two, but certainly it will be in my top five somewhere. One thing that we didn't really call out during the course of all this is this film's unique musical approach. The score is definitely like African music influenced, as it should be, and it's done, I think, very well. But also, the original songs, largely produced and coordinated by Kendrick Lamar, are just outstanding. I've listened to the whole soundtrack two or three times all the way through now, and it's one of the best movie soundtracks I've ever heard. So this is, you know, one more feather in this movie's cap. It is absolutely a worldwide phenomenon. If you get a chance to see this in IMAX, absolutely do it. It looks gorgeous. And just be prepared to be enthralled and for Black Panther to be everybody's new favorite superhero.
Yeah, I agree with both of you guys. This is – I'm not ready to rank it yet. Easily top 10 for me. Probably going to end up well, I don't want to go into the details. We'll get to that eventually one day. But I will say this is phenomenal. This is just another landmark in the MCU. And in many ways – perhaps the most important MCU movie, at least since Iron Man, because this is a movie that is going to speak to a new audience in a way that Wonder Woman did last year for DC. And I just can't say enough about how good it is. So go out and watch this. Russell says to watch it in IMAX if you have a chance. And I would say that if you have a chance, to go watch it on Rusev Day.
Every day is Rusev Day.
Amen to that. Now, before we go to the commercial break here and head off to our normal weekly duties, as Russell departs, Russell, tell us a little bit about what you might have in your coffers coming up here at Place to Be Nation Pop, Sellers Point, and beyond, perhaps.
Well, as you guys know, Sellers Points is currently in a bit of a transition period. I am without a co-host, so I'm in the process of trying to find a new permanent co-host for the show. Bobby Boucher says, the switch continues.
You're like our Kelly Ripa at Place to Be Nation Pop.
Yeah.
You're going to be trying out some new things here.
Yeah, there's going to be hopefully some tryouts here. A couple of guests who've never been on the show before are going to be coming on to do a little talking shop, talking comics. That's what we do on the old Sellers Points podcast. We actually had one just dropped today. Jennifer Smith from Geek and Sassy joined me to do something that I believe you guys have already done, which was our list of the top five superhero comics.
Yeah, but we did it in written form, so that means nobody saw it.
Well, I read it. I thought it was good. And we decided to do this as, you know, since it's the month of February, you guys had Black Panther month, and we figured, let's do a Valentine's Day kind of episode.
Yes.
I'm done.
I'm so glad you did, because Nick made me skip the Heart Traveling Fanboys this year. So I'm glad you did that.
Yes, we covered that. But coming up in March, because as of right now, the Sellers Points podcast is going to be a monthly show until a permanent co-host is found, and then we'll see what kind of format we can turn it into after that. But coming up in March, Place to Be Nation's Brad Warren is going to be making his, PTBN Pop debut.
Nice get.
Mm-hmm. He's going to be coming on to discuss that long thread of his in the Place to Be Nation comics group on Facebook,
which everyone should join.
Kind of falling down the comics rabbit holes. That'll be a unique take.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about his journey to becoming a comics fan from listening to you guys and to our show, or to my show, and just talking about the stuff that he's read, like what's working for him, what hasn't. You know, the journey from being a fledgling comic book reader to being a kind of an obsessive, like the rest of us. How did it happen? And basically, this will be Brad Warren's secret origin as a comic book fan.
Nice. We know something about that. I want you to ask him. My one request is I want you to ask him to expound on his thoughts on Bane's back hair.
That is probably going to be question number one. I can't leave that off. And then coming up in April, I guess, can we announce this now? Because both
I think
of you
so.
Guys,
coming
up in April, we're going to be doing another big current events show where we're going to be taking a look at Doomsday Clock's latest issue, which should be issue 5 by that point, as well as Action Comics 1000. And we're going to be doing a full crossover event with the Hard Trial. Both of you guys are going to be on the show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to be a grand old time. I'm finally freed of my hosting duties, my navigational duties. So
yes, you won't have to do that. And of course, I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on that one, Nick, as a huge Brian Bendis fan. Once the issue is out and we can get a little taste of what Bendis's Superman is going to be like.
Yeah, you know, I've made no secret of it. I am apprehensive right now, but we will see.
Absolutely, and of course, joining us on that particular episode will be another longtime listener and you know, pretty good participant in a different comics discussion that we're all a part of. Mr. Joe Johnson will be making his PTB and Pop debut. So
very cool.
So it's going to be a full house for our next current events. But those are all the shows that I have planned coming up. And beyond that, we'll just have to see.
I think one last question before we have to head to break. But you and Todd, I think, might be returning to your metal series. Is that correct for Pod
yes.
Blasts?
Yeah, we got one more Pod Blast. We got two Pod Blasts left for Dark Knight's Metal. We haven't gotten around to the newest one yet that covers issue 5 and Dark Knight's Rising, The Wild Hunt, which features an even larger mouthful of creators than its title. I've only just read half of that issue so far, and to describe it as batshit is a bit of an understatement, but this is what happens whenever you put Scott Snyder and Grant Morrison together, I suppose. And
as you know,
that sigh. There's the exacerbated dick sigh.
As you know, Russell, I'm always fond of a mouthful of creators,
especially a mouthful of Morrison, I'm sure.
Yes, yes, I'll take all that Scottish man beast that I can handle in terms of writing.
Yeah. He fills your hole in forever.
Oh, that's good. Anyway, we do have to head to break. Thank you so much, Russell, for taking time out of your schedule to join us here for the Hard Traveling Fanboys look at Black Panther. Glad you joined us for the movie. Glad you joined us for the show.
Thank you guys for having me. It was always a blast to join the old HTF crew for some fun times.
And as for the rest of you guys out there and girls and everyone else, anyone else that might be listening, dogs, cats, whatever, we hope you stick through the break, listen to these commercials for some of the other great PTB and Pop shows. In the meantime, while you're on the commercial break, why don't you go on to Facebook.com, join Place to Be Nation Comics. We have an active and lively community there. And also, you can tweet us. I am at gphillips8652. Nick is at nickduke87. Russell, how can they find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Russell_Sellers. And tell me your top 5 superhero comics couples while you're at it. I'm looking for other people's lists. And also, any old ideas you guys have about what the what might sound good on the Sellers Points podcast, I appreciate hearing from anybody and everybody. Love the discussion, and you know, I am part of that Facebook group as well, so hit me up anytime you guys want to talk some shop.
Sounds good, and that goes for us as well. Let us know what you like on the show, what you'd like to hear more of on the show. We will make it happen to the best of our abilities. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacetoBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacetoBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We are back in the hard traveling studios here in beautiful Vancouver, BC. We definitely appreciate Russell joining us. And, you know, I had a thought, Nick, during the break.
Mm-hmm.
That thought is a simple name.
Mm-hmm.
And that name is James L. Dickey.
Oh.
Sadly, we're not going to be talking about Mr. Dickey today.
Is he going to take you on a Dickey ride?
I don't know. I don't trust this James L. Dickey. Actually, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Dickey. Mr. James L. Dickey, in fact.
I'm still waiting for the all-rap edition of Easy Like David Sunday. That is my most anticipated episode of that podcast, whenever
that
it may happen.
That could be the show that breaks the internet. If that finally happens. And I want to be a part of it. I don't want to just hear it. I want to be a part of it.
You just
reenact a famous that we won't speak of.
You want to suggest various song titles for David to read out loud on the podcast. Essentially,
I would never do such a thing. I would.
Hey,
never,
David, read
I would
this
never
one.
Stoop to such levels.
Read this one. Read this one.
No, not me. I wouldn't do that to him. But what I would do is give a nice plug to Sunday Groove,
Easy
which
Like
can be
David
found right
Sunday.
Here on Place to Be Nation Pop. And,
you know, for the last few minutes, we've talked in very calm and rational tones. It sounds like a fucking NPR podcast right now. I don't like it.
And now we reach our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of the comic book world. Now we reach the rundown.
Who wants to walk with Weber? Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
That's right, folks. It's the rundown. And the biggest news story this week in the world of comics comes to us from the at times beleaguered offices of Marvel Comics. As stop me if you've heard this one when it comes to DC, Marvel, etc. But we're getting an overhaul across the entire Marvel publishing line because the entire Marvel Universe is getting a, quote, fresh start, end quote, in May 2018, a line-wide change that will be the latest in what seems to be a yearly Marvel rebranding initiative. This will include, as it always does, new series, new creative teams, new directions, and, Marvel promises, new beginnings. So there's a lot that encompasses this, Nick, and mm-hmm. we'll get into some of these specifics, but we have been very vocal in the past mm-hmm. in mocking Marvel's Now and Point Now and Now 2.0 initiatives, and I am going to join in the chorus in mocking this as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know,
they just did Legacy.
I agree. I agree. I guess I reached a point where I am so far removed from, like, the overall, like, right now with DC, I read enough DC and I follow enough DC that I can kind of tell you what the big goings-on are in the DC universe. With Marvel, if it's not happening to Thor or Jessica Jones, I can't tell you that much about it. I don't know what the real shape of the universe looks like. I don't know what the Avengers are doing. I don't have the slightest clue. And so when these things happen, I just kind of shrug my shoulders and say, well, I'm not really reading that many Marvel books anyway, and the ones that I do are fairly self-contained. Plus, with this one, it kind of coincides with Brian Michael Bendis leaving the company, which is, like, literally, I mean, half my Marvel books. I'm probably going to be dropping the Miles Morales book, dropping the Jessica Jones book. Defenders is ending. And really, that's going to leave me with just The Mighty Thor, written by Jason Aaron. And so, you know, I agree. It's really dumb. It's something they've become obsessed with to a degree that doesn't make sense. And I know you said we want to dive into the specifics here. It is, they are trying to, in the ultimate sign of trying to have their cake and eat it too, they wanted to siphon off some of the heat that DC had built up for itself with the reversion to legacy numbering. Marvel did that with Legacy, and now is trying to have its cake and eat it too by both renumbering while simultaneously maintaining Legacy numbering on titles. So, like, for example, the flagship title of this relaunch is going to be a new Avengers title written by Jason Aaron and drawn by Ed McGuinness that apparently is going to carry a number 698 and a number 1 on it when it launches, which is so, just pick one. Do you want to have the number 1 or do you want to have 698? Which one do you want? To me, I don't think it matters as much as people make it out to, but for God's sake, pick a direction. Decide what you want to be and go with it. But I say all that, and because I don't really care about the state of the line overall, this is probably going to be much like it is for Marvel Now with me, where coming out of this, I think there are going to be some titles for me that I am interested in. Obviously, Jason Aaron doing an Avengers book is something I've wanted for a long time because, you know, I've wanted to see the Avengers get back to kind of being a book that you really can't miss. And I think with him on there, him getting to write
as opposed to a book that if you miss an issue, you don't understand what's going on.
Right. So, you know, I'm excited about that. Dan Slott is leaving Spider-Man finally, thank God. And the hot rumor du jour is that Spencer will be taking over the title. And as someone who actually, yes, enjoyed Secret Empire and has enjoyed what of Nick Spencer's work I've read, and the fact that he's not Dan Slott, I'll probably be picking that up as well. But so, you know, there are things here that I can find that intrigue me and that I will probably read and enjoy. But in terms of the overall Fresh Start initiative, I just don't care at this point.
Yeah, there was a thread that I think we talked about on the show here recently, a couple months ago. Maybe we didn't, but I know we talked about it on Facebook. It was a Twitter thread by a guy that really delved deeply into the issues with Marvel from a retail perspective, from a business perspective, and really got into the specifics of all of the issues that have led to the comics industry being the way it is today, and particularly Marvel, which shockingly, in the last year, while all sales have been down, Marvel appears to have ceded much of its territory in the last year and a half or so. And it's a culmination of years of events and years of things just like this, where you promise people things and you don't deliver on your promises. This is going to be an earth-shaking event that will have ramifications for years on the Marvel Universe. Until the next 6 months later, when you counteract that with the next event, that's the biggest thing to ever hit the Marvel Universe and completely undoes the last event. And, you know, the dual numbering is almost a mockery. It's almost like something that you would expect in an Onion article about Marvel Comics, where, hey, we're relaunching with a new number one, but we're also keeping the old numbering for you old timers. See, everybody's happy, but in fact, nobody's happy with it. So, not to say that the initiative won't be successful in some ways, not to say that there won't be great creative teams. None of my mockery or derision of this is ever directed at the creative teams, because for the most part, any initiative is going to have great titles and great creative teams in its midst. The New 52, for instance, which we've mocked at times, was very successful at the beginning and had some great creative teams and some great books. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's doubling down on the same things that have damaged the comic book industry and that have made it, while comic book films get bigger and bigger, comic books become more and more niche. It feels like.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be the way that it is.
And, you know, you talk about that thread, talk about the things, the issues that plague Marvel from a retail perspective and from a sales perspective. And here's the thing, though. I have, you know, after the last, you know, 2 years or so of Rebirth coming along and kind of really helping DC to take a big chunk out of that Marvel, you know, sales lead, I don't think Marvel is interested in changing its policies in the least unless they were to lose the market share lead for a prolonged period of time. You know, DC took it there after the beginning of Rebirth for, like, what was it, Greg, 2 to 3 months, and then Marvel came along with, I believe, a relaunch in November of that year and took it right back and has held it since. The issue with that is the Star Wars line and various other licensed lines are propping up Marvel sales to a degree right. That I don't even know if it's possible for DC to overtake Marvel in terms of market share long term. And if I'm a Marvel exec, I go, you know, all these complaints happen, but we're still number one in the industry, and it's the WWE thing where because you're on top, you want to rest on your laurels, and that's what I see in Marvel right now. And like I said, unless they were to somehow lose market share lead long term, I don't see any of this actually changing.
As any Arrow fan can tell you, it's never good to rest on your laurels. but I will say, looking at the numbers from December and November, I mean, these top 10 charts are DC heavy. I mean, you've got – this is the December numbers. You've got Doomsday Clock at 1, Dark Knight's Metal at 2, Phoenix Resurrection at 3 for Marvel, then 2 Batman books, Batman White Knight right after that, an Amazing Spider-Man, and a Marvel 2-in-1, and then of all things, Hawkman Found at at number 9. You know, I mean, you're talking.
But what's the market share 20, still? Like, what in terms of percentage, what are we looking at?
I'm trying to find that on here, and let me scroll down a little bit through the ridiculous amount of books that are published. They don't have they usually have that listed here on this list. But suffice it to say, the top 20, I think I counted 4 Marvel books, and that's including Star Wars, maybe 5 counting Star Wars. And now granted, I mean, DC's being propped up by all the Batman books, but still, I think the highest ranking non-Batman book is Superman.
I don't know if this is how recent this is, but according to Comicron, Marvel still maintains a half a percentage point lead over DC with a 34.3% market share to DC's 33.8%, which pretty much puts the two companies on about equal footing, which was 2 years ago, pre-Rebirth, unheard of. Like, not even a thought in their mind. But the fact that even at kind of what feels like Marvel's creative valley, you know, in the past decade, and DC's kind of creative peak, they're still about on equal footing. And I think that's why Marvel doesn't really feel the need to be innovative and to do things that are ultra fan pleasing at this point. They've settled into their yearly relaunch cycle where they get their boost off the number ones, and that's good enough for them to hold the lead, and I think that's all they care about at this point.
And interestingly, one of the main points of that thread that we talked about was how Marvel has ignored the trade industry by and large, has ignored bookstores, has ignored the way that young people are consuming comic books in many ways outside of digital. And do you know which publisher has the number one trade or collection for the month of December?
Image.
Image, yep, with
Walking
Saga
Dead.
Volume 8.
Oh, I was going to say Walking Dead, but yeah.
No, Saga Volume 8 is at number one at a $14.99 price point. So there's a lot of issues, and they're not easy to solve, but I don't think doubling down on this is easy. Now, all that being said, let's look at the bright side. And the bright side, as you mentioned, Jason Aaron taking over the Avengers alongside Superman Batman artist Ed McGuinness. Who, of course, drew that great title for Jeff Loeb back in the day for DC, has done a ton of work for Marvel and DC. He's known for his kind of over-the-top cartoony style, but he is pairing with Jason Aaron, and I know you are particularly excited about this Avengers book, which will bring Steve Rogers, Tony Stark, and OG Thor together with a smaller roster of heroes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously very excited about it. I've yet to read a Jason Aaron book that I just absolutely love. I guess the one I liked the least was probably his Doctor Strange run, but even that I enjoyed very much what I read. I just couldn't find room for it on my pull list, which at the time was massive and needed to be scaled back some. But also, one thing, you know, of course we're going to knock on the constant relaunches, but one thing that does, you know, seem to be a positive in terms of at least this Avengers book is they seem to have learned their lesson in terms of brand dilution a little bit, where there aren't going to be, at least initially, 5 different Avengers books out there. There's going to be 1 Avengers book. It's going to ship a little bit more frequently than your average monthly title. But if you want to follow the Avengers, it's a one-stop shop. He's already promising that the roster will see some turnover, so you don't have to worry about characters being neglected. You know, there will be guys cycling in and out. And it kind of, according to Aaron anyway, is going to be the book that drives the Marvel Universe, which is, in my opinion, what an Avengers title should be. So I'm highly excited about that. And of course, I can't say it often enough, no Dan Slott Spider-Man in this initiative. So big positives on that in that regard anyway.
Yeah, the initial lineup, it looks like, is going to be Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, mm-hmm. Captain Marvel, She-Hulk, who appears to have been embiggened, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, and the Robbie Reyes Ghost Rider.
Yeah, the She-Hulk has been embiggened in recent months because after Civil War II and the death of Bruce Banner, she lost control and became even more angry, and so they kind of went with the classic Hulk take of the angrier she gets, the more powerful she becomes, and so it's kind of been a more aggressive She-Hulk than the typical light green-skinned intelligent She-Hulk that we've seen in years past.
But this is a pretty cool lineup.
Yeah, I agree.
This is a,
it's a good mix,
a nice
of classic
new and old.
Right, yeah. Classic characters with new characters and classic characters who are now enjoying a higher profile, like Black Panther and like Captain Marvel, who will have her big screen debut early next year. So I think this makes a lot of sense in a lot of different regards, and I am very excited about it. It will definitely be one of the few Marvel books that's on my pull list, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. Jason Aaron did a great job writing that Marvel Legacy one-shot, even if it wasn't nearly as important as the DC Rebirth one-shot that they tried to compare it to, but still a very good book that sets up some intriguing plot threads. And they mention one of the story aspects is he's going to be borrowing a framing device from his Thor God of Thunder run, in that the story will take place across multiple time periods, which gives us another opportunity to see Jason Aaron write some Odin, which is always fantastic.
Yes, and that kind of encapsulates all the news on this this turnover to this point. I'm sure there's going to be more announcements rolled out in the near future.
Yeah, apparently the full solicits for May are coming. They will be out by the time people are listening to this podcast. So on next week's show, we should have a better idea of what this is really going to look like. Some confirmation of some titles. I mentioned earlier the Spencer rumored Spider-Man, and I think there's also a rumor out there that Ta-Nehisi Coates will potentially be taking over Captain America from Mark Waid. So variety of interesting things out there, and I'm intrigued to see what the full lineup looks like, or at least the books they want to be spearheading the lineup.
Indeed. And from Marvel, let's switch over to the Distinguished Competition. And DC's got a number of comic book changes that have been announced and appear to be on the way. We've primarily got news of some cancellations. This is in advance of the Scott Snyder Justice League No Surrender, I believe is the name of it, event. Is that, or am I getting that confused with Avengers?
I believe it's No Justice.
No Justice, yeah.
Right.
So that's coming up, and with that are a number of changes that have been announced. Number one on the list, I will start with my favorite character in comics, which is Dick Grayson, Nightwing, who I have had a complicated relationship with his solo title over the years, since my return to comics in the early 2000s. The new team on his book will be Benjamin Percy, who is known for his work on Green Arrow ever since Rebirth began, a little bit before that, in fact, as well as Teen Titans. Percy is off Green Arrow, as we learned recently, and will be taking over Nightwing beginning with issue number 44, that includes a storyline called The Bleeding Edge that will apparently have effects on the entire DCU. It's going to be taking place in Bloodhaven, as was established in the Rebirth Nightwing run. And, you know, I'm always interested in new teams taking over Nightwing, so we'll see what this one is like. Nick?
Yeah, I know you aren't as high on the Percy Green Arrow run as I was, but I think Nightwing, at least in terms of the street-level setting, will continue to be something that he is comfortable doing. And it gets him a little closer to Gotham, which I know is something he's always kind of wanted to do more of since his initial foray in writing that two-part Detective Comics book back during the New 50, or story back during the New 52. So while I don't know that I'm going to read this, just because I've been so burned by Nightwing solo titles pretty much every time they've done one over the last 5 years, I pick it up and I never enjoy it as much as, you know, I feel like I should be for my money. I am intrigued to see where what he does with the character, and I'm excited that he's going to continue to play a role for the street-level DC characters. But I guess more notable in terms of the DC announcements of changes.
Let me chime in real quick with one more thing on that. I feel like everybody – it feels to me, and I couldn't be wrong on this. I feel like everybody that writes Nightwing has one story that they want to tell. And so they come out of the gates firing, and then they fizzle after that. And I thought that was the case with the Tim Seeley run, where he had a pretty good arc with Raptor and then fizzled. And even in the past with runs from prior writers over the years, it feels like nobody really has a long-term vision for Dick Grayson, because there's this view of him as being somehow inherently less than. And I hope that changes moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. But Also on the DC front, I guess the more impactful changes that are coming in the next couple of months. You know, we talked just a minute ago, Greg, about Marvel kind of having this fresh start, you know, big relaunch effort. And while DC isn't necessarily promoting this as a relaunch or a reboot, doesn't this kind of feel like a big sea change in the terms of the publishing lineup? Because at the same time, essentially, you've got Brian Michael Bendis coming on and taking over the entirety of the Superman line, both Superman and Action Comics, and then you've got Scott Snyder coming on and shepherding all of the Justice League titles. You know, as you mentioned earlier, there's going to be a four-week weekly No Justice crossover that's going to cross over between Justice League Titans, Justice League, Justice League of America, Teen Titans, and Titans. And before spinning off into a new Justice League book that will be written by Scott Snyder and other associated Justice League books to be written by people who will be working closely with Snyder. I know James Tynion IV and I believe Josh Williamson have also been confirmed to be doing Justice League titles. So as a result of that, both Bendis taking over Superman and Snyder taking over Justice League, multiple titles across the DC line have been canceled. Supergirl and Super Sons both canceled. And then, of course, while they haven't been officially confirmed yet, Justice League of America, Titans, and Teen Titans are all heavily rumored to be ending in May as well. So, looks like a sizable shakeup to the DC publishing line coming here in the next couple of months.
Absolutely. Also, Harley Quinn appears to be
right
from the solicitations, but I would be stunned if they flat out cancel Harley Quinn.
No, they'll relaunch it or give a new spin on it. Like, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see, you know, a Harley and Ivy ongoing or mm-hmm. something in that regard. You know, but there's no way a Harley book is not going to be on the stands.
I think the one of these announcements that appears to have had the most effect on people, or the most fear instilled in people with Super Sons, and I admit I was one of them, because we talked about on this very show, I believe, Nick, about when we talked about the Brian Michael Bendis interview, the concern about his statements about Superman status quo changing in a way that it hasn't since Crisis on Infinite Earths. The instant thing I thought to was undoing the marriage and undoing John Kent, which I'm sure there are some Silver Age, Bronze Age Superman fans that are not fond of that concept of Superman having a son. And certainly the cancellation of one of DC's most successful titles brought some fear with it. Because we're talking about those sales numbers. Super Sons is outselling the vast majority of the books that don't have Superman or Batman in the title, whether it be Detective, Batman, Superman, and Action. I think Super Sons is right behind those books on monthly sales right now. And I think we were all surprised by that and taken a little bit aback. But the good news is Peter Tomasi has thrown water on that fire. He says that this was a move out of a sorry change, not based on sales, and that John is sticking around with Damian. They're going to be together, and that he is going to have a big role in their future at DC. So that's good news for fans of the Boy of Steel and his friendship with the rather aggressive Robin.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't that concerned about it, just because I know, you know, we talk all the time about how, you know, these comic companies need to reach out to young readers, and I know that the creation of John Kent has been a potential avenue to do that, and I did not see DC making the decision to de-emphasize him so soon after he has gained popularity. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have, especially as we get prepared for the launch of the streaming service next year with the third season of Young Justice on there, a lot of sense for a rebranded Titans and or Young Justice title with John and Damian front and center, kind of bringing together. You know, it's interesting in the DC universe now that you've kind of got three distinct generations. You've got the old guard of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. You've kind of got those classic Titans who are in the middle, and then you have the younger Titans like Damian and the new kid Flash and John there. And I think there's a lot of potential in potentially melding those two generations of Titans together into one team, some pick and choose some elements there. But all around, big changes on the horizon for DC, and I'm, as always, excited and intrigued to see what the future holds.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see where things go with all of this, positively, negatively, or in between. And we'll be right here on the front lines to report on it here at the Rundown. And with that being said, I think that's the end of our Rundown this week, Nick.
It is.
And that can only mean that it's time for the longest-running weekly segment in our show, and that is Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What you've been reading and watching.
Now,
reading, there is none.
No. We haven't been doing a lot of reading lately, folks. But we're going to solve that with some long book hunts in the future. And some Helen Hunts as well, probably. So,
you and your damn Helen Hunt.
And you know what, Nick? I think that of all the topics to talk about on a show, Helen Hunt is as good as it gets. And with that, I'll move on.
You just want her to give you a titty twister.
Come on now. Come on. I wouldn't denigrate Helen Hunt in such a way. Especially now. Just kidding.
Let's be honest. Let's be honest, Greg. You know, if we're really being honest, even at her peak, Helen Hunt did share some similarities with Basil Exposition's mother.
No,
she was a bit mannish.
No, that's
she was
not
a bit
true. That is
a
not
bit
fair.
Mannish. It, yeah.
No,
yeah.
For
Helen Hunt's sake, let's just be glad you didn't come along in the era of high definition. That's all I'm going to say.
My gosh, that is a ridiculous, slanderous. I'm not even sure what, but probably an ist. Claim for you to make, so I'm gonna move on to the
much like Bianca Belair in NXT. I am the est of the hard traveling fanboys.
Worstest. Oh, so we are on watching because we did watch. We had things to watch.
Not that many though, because you know we can't watch things, Greg, because the Winter Olympics are on television right now.
Yes, people may be interested to see what noted figure skater James L. Dickey accomplished at the Winter Olympics.
He actually performed his routine to Dickey Ride, strangely enough.
Yes, indeed he did. And you know that everybody's gathering around their television to watch the slalom.
Slalom.
But anyway, yes.
Yeah, so. Actually, now that I think about it, I think that actually makes some level of sense, because isn't NBC still a part owner of the CW?
I don't know.
Or Universal?
I just realized I made the same sound as the beginning of Muhammad Hassan's theme song. Oh gosh. Anyway, 2005, folks. It was a good. Well, no, it was a year. It was a year in the industry.
Never mind. It's a joint venture between CBS, so it doesn't even make sense from that perspective. From a synergistic perspective, it doesn't make sense.
And you know what the crazy thing is, Nick? I looked at the ratings that the Winter Olympics got on Sunday. 15.4 million people watched the Winter Olympics on Sunday. Can you believe that?
Yeah, because how many people watch the fucking Big Bang Theory? And I'd rather watch the Winter Olympics than ever watch Sheldon do anything.
Oh, that's true. I agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly. And also, go Norway. Norway is just kicking ass.
Shouldn't we be pulling for our own country, the United States of America?
I like to pick out. I'm a realist, first of all, and I like to pick. I also like to pick out, you know, interesting countries that have good stories. And in the case of this, I'm a Norwegian bandwagon jumper.
I'm surprised, since it's a sporting event, you haven't found the country with the highest Mormon population and sought it out to attach your bandwagon to.
Goodness. These are just...
Accurate are statements? Just yes, they
controversial
are.
Controversial statements, in my opinion.
Why are they controversial?
The statements...
You have a bizarre fascination with Brigham Young University, the University of Utah, and all things in Utah.
What's,
for reasons that are unexplained.
It? What's bizarre about it?
The fact that you can't really explain your... is it the underwear? Is it the polygamy? What is it, Greg? Tell me.
Again, with the polygamy. What an offensive comment to our Mormon listeners out there in
my
Utah.
God.
Just a just dragging this show into the pits is my co-host Nick Duke, and I'd just like to say, for those of you out there that are offended right now, I would urge you to tweet my cohort Nick Duke
at JRsBBQ. Yes.
And let him know how you feel about
his
words on this show. Now, watching. Let's do watching, Nick. We watched shows last week. Only two of them, thanks to the stupid Winter Olympics and the stupid decision-making of the CW.
Yes.
So, and by the way, as a spoiler alert, Nick, this next episode will only have one thing for us to watch, because Black Lightning was off this
week. Yeah, I picked up on that when at the end of this week's Black Lightning, there was no preview for next week's Black Lightning. It was just a generic trailer for stuff that's happened on the show already, and I said, oh, know what that means.
Mm-hmm. So, in any event, we had on Monday night the return of Legends of Tomorrow.
Yes, we did.
Legends of Tomorrow, sorry. And, boy, I thought they knocked it out of the park with this return, Nick. They returned in as Legends away as possible and brought in elements of a long-lost NBC series called Constantine.
Yep.
Because we'd see the return of John Constantine, played by
Matt Ryan. Wasn't this a much better usage of Constantine than his initial appearance in the CW verse on Arrow last season? I mean, leagues better. Not that that was bad or anything, but
no, that was
I thought this was just absolutely blow away outstanding. Loved it from beginning to end with the a little bit of a convoluted plot, admittedly, in terms of the different versions of the characters being trapped in different times, but it's Legends. You got to be willing to go with a part of that. And then Matt Ryan's Constantine, his chemistry with Katie Lotz's Sarah Lance is just off the charts. Mm-hmm. Loved everything about this episode and can't wait for him to – apparently he's going to be back later this season. And let's hope it portends a larger future on Legends of Tomorrow, maybe in season 4 and forward. Need to see more of Matt Ryan's Constantine in the CW verse.
Like to see a season with him on the ship.
Yes, agreed.
For the duration, because he's awesome. His chemistry was awesome. It felt, especially that opening scene, did it not feel like a scene from the Constantine series?
And how about the fact they were able to get away with him smoking and stuff on the show, which is something they always, like, were very coy about on the NBC show.
Even made a recurring joke out of it.
Yes.
During the course of the episode. Every time he starts to light up, something stops him. And then at the very end, he lights up. And, you know, it was just a great episode all around. Tremendous development also for Damian Dark and his daughter, mm-hmm. as you kind of tie it together of how she ends up helping him out in his quest, and he continues to be an ultra charismatic villain every time he appears. And honestly, probably as great as he was individually on Arrow, a better fit for Legends of Tomorrow.
Absolutely, because he was always a kind of a bombastic presence on Arrow in a season that was trying to take itself so overwhelmingly seriously for such an inherently silly concept and plot for the season that it never really fit. But on Legends, he has found his niche for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so going forward, it sets you up for a lot of interesting developments in the future. Now, on to Tuesday night and Black Lightning, which is episode 5, I believe, of Black Lightning. And this episode gave us a little bit about the origin of Tobias Hoyle.
Yes.
And we see a little bit more about Tobias and his sister. And we also get some new powers displayed by Jefferson in his suit that also are taking a toll on his body, a toll that he appears to be ignoring. And we also find out a little bit more about the tailor, so to speak, Jefferson's right-hand man who appears to be playing both sides of the fence to a degree. He seems to mean well, but he's keeping a lot of secrets from our titular hero, secrets that I think are going to come back to haunt everyone in the end. And we also got the continuing development of Thunder, the daughter of Black Lightning, and we also got more, including her in a pretty funny homage to the comics with her superhero costume, and then also the youngest daughter as well, learning to fight, to use a quote from a movie that I enjoy. But this led to some, I think, necessary bonding time between Jefferson and his youngest daughter that we haven't really seen a lot of in the show. Although I have to say, by the way, dude, she was totally in the right. She shouldn't have been punished at all.
I would agree with that. Yeah, you know, this was an okay episode of Black Lightning, but, you know, for a – this is a show that has set the bar so high. That I feel like this one was the weakest to date for me anyway. It had some interesting things that happened, but as a – you know, in terms of a cohesive narrative, one central theme of the episode, I didn't feel like it really held together very well. It felt to me more like a collection of scenes rather than telling, you know, one chapter in the story. So I liked it all right, but I feel like it was a little bit below the standard we've come to expect from Black Lightning.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think the best scenes were the Tobias Hoyle scenes in this one. I enjoyed seeing his origin, particularly his, you know, abusive childhood and his revisit to his old man. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a good scene, really good development for him and his sister, who I didn't actually know was his sister, I have to admit, until this episode. But yeah, really good stuff here overall. But yeah, I agree with you. Probably the weakest episode to date. But still, plenty to like there, and I'm excited to see it going forward. I will say, I think that as it goes on, it's settling a little bit into normalcy in terms of becoming more of a normal superhero show.
And they are trying to stretch out Black Lightning. Like, we at least need to see them interact at some point, you know, him and Whale, which we haven't seen. It's just, it feels like it's starting to artificially stretch a bit, which is never a good thing.
Marvel Netflix syndrome.
Yes, exactly.
I did like the scene that we saw where Black Lightning's powers failed him and he kind of got his ass kicked a little bit by this little weasel character that would have stood no chance against him otherwise.
Right.
So we'll see.
Who of course didn't kill him. You know, he could have just killed Black Lightning and that would have been that. But
yeah. But why would a villain ever do that? Mm. Why don't we just kill the guy? I mean, we got him right here. We'll do it together. It'll be fun.
I have a gun in my room. I'll go get it.
You just don't get it, do you? I'm going to place him in an easily escapable trap, leave him alone, and assume everything goes to plan. What? Anyway, so we can't really do a rank him because there's only two episodes this week.
Here, Legends of Tomorrow at number one, Binding at number two. How about that?
Yeah, Legends won the week for sure. A tremendous episode.
Also, spoiler alert for next week, good. Legends of Tomorrow, number one.
Yes, and also in last place.
I said number one.
So anyway, really happy to have Legends back. Excited to see where Black Lightning goes from here. We only have one more week before we get our regular schedule back again, I think. So,
well, not really our regular schedule because Supergirl is on that bizarre rotational hiatus with Legends now.
And hey, speaking of Superman, we got Krypton creeping around the corner.
We sure do have Krypton creeping around the corner, and it will be a thing that I will probably not watch.
Well, isn't that just cute? What about the Danny Hodge story? A recurring miniseries coming to HBO this spring.
That's not possible. There's no man alive great enough to play Hodge.
To play Hodge, that's true. What if Arnold played Hodge, though?
No, Arnold, you know, first of all, he's not an American. He's not born in the middle of God's country, Oklahoma, like the great Dan Hodge. So there really is no one out there.
Nick, do you think that Dan Hodge is the reason God made Oklahoma?
No, Dan Hodge is the reason Oklahoma made God, I think.
And they named him Danny Hodge.
Yes.
And they saw that he was good.
For Hodge so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
And on the eighth day, Hodge crushed an apple with his bare hands.
And it was good. And saw that it was good.
I know Danny Hodge, and he's good. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Randy Watson. In any event, we're going to be bringing this podcast to a close. We hope you've enjoyed the proceedings.
Have we offended enough people of various faiths at this point between the Mormons and the Jim Ross version of the New Testament or the Old Testament?
You know, anyone that is taking anything that we say seriously
in any way,
please don't.
Please get a life would be my advice to you.
So, we hope you've enjoyed the proceedings. We thank Russell for joining us earlier in the evening. We thank...
you may hear him on this show again sooner rather than later.
Yes, as we are working on... We vigorously work on the next bit of Place to Be Nation Pop Theater. So be tuned to your airwaves in the next few months here, and you'll catch some familiar voices and some celebrities that may be stopping by.
Indeed.
And with that, we're going to sign off here, although I do want to give some time for a final thought.
All right.
And in this case, I want Nick and I to take maybe a minute, maybe 2 minutes here to just talk about some of our least favorite country and western songs. Songs that a radio station that's very near and dear to our hearts, 96.9 The Legend, play on constant loop.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go first. And I've already mentioned.
Damn it. You're a son of a bitch.
I've already mentioned You're the Reason God Made Oklahoma.
Yeah, that one's not good.
No, I'm gonna excise that, but I'm gonna add a song by the Oak Ridge Boys.
Oh, here we go.
Called My Baby is American Made.
Yes. Great song.
Not even a good, great. Not good playoffs.
Great song.
Not even a good song.
Great song.
Not even a listenable song.
Great song.
Horrible song.
Not a horrible song.
Now those
song.
Are my picks. I think I had another one I mentioned to you earlier, Nick, but I don't remember what it was.
Nor do I at the moment. For me, I'm going to go with, I don't even know who sings the fucking song, but there's this terrible, and here's the thing about this one, it's not a country song, but they keep playing it on country radio. It's a song called I Wanna Bop With You Baby. Apparently it is recorded by a man named Dan Seals, who is just awful.
Yes! Dan Seals, come on!
Just terrible. And, they should not be playing this on country or any other genre of radio.
You know, speaking of 96.9 The Legend, I heard something earlier that I need you to make sense out of. Sometimes you get these things that I don't get.
No.
The guy,
no.
You know, the awesome voice guy that kind of sounds like Sam Elliott came on. He's like, you remember when we used to put peanuts in a Coke bottle? Then you're one of us.
Yes.
Classic country, The Legend. What the hell is the deal with peanuts in a Coke bottle?
You know, I have wondered that, what exactly it is supposed to be. And apparently it's something that they did in the South back in the day. And they would just pour a bag of peanuts into the bottom of a Coke. Why? I don't know. I guess it's to pair a little bit of sweet and salt together, as people like to do, but I can't really understand it. It makes no sense to me, but I do know that it was referenced in the Barbara Mandrell song, I Was Country When Country Wasn't Cool.
When country wasn't cool. Hell yeah.
See, that's what we're threatening the listeners with now, Greg, is our own musical podcast. It's about nothing but pre-1989 country music.
Even fewer people will listen to us at that point.
And at that point,
and oddly enough, even more will be offended.
Even more. Well, you know, there are some thoughts expressed by most country artists. Of course, the most offensive show we would do would be our David Allan Coe retrospective. That would be, for no one to hear. Let it be remembered, Greg, I was into whips and things, and she was into pain.
She was into chicken. Good Lord. Well, that's all, folks. We'll catch you next week here in Ho Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And we will, I believe, Nick, be joined by Jennifer Smith to review the movie Ant-Man in our continued series, Hard Travelers for Hire.
Scott Antman.
Scott Antman. All right, guys. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back same time next week, unless we are canceled in the interim.
Hard traveling fanboys. Sorry, I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party.